Should minors be allowed to have an abortion without parental consent? Welcome to Sundial, I'm Nadege Green. The controversial Parental Bill of Rights legislation says no, and the bill is making its way through the Florida legislature. We'll hear where the bill's sponsors stand and concerns from reproductive health advocates. Plus, new census figures show South Florida's population has ballooned over the past decade. But could that trend change soon? A census demographer joins us to explain the data. We'll also learn how the citizenship question proposed for the 2020 census is impacting their work. Finally, a new exhibit at the Museum of Contemporary Art in North Miami takes us to Port-au-Prince, Haiti's capital, and introduces us to some of the leading contemporary artists. I'm Nadege Green, all of that today on Sundial. First, the news. A Florida bill is making its way through the legislature that would require minors to get consent from their parents or legal guardian before they can get an abortion. Welcome to Sundial. This is Nadege Green. I'm filling in for Luis Hernandez. Florida is already a notification state. By law, parents are informed before minors can undergo the medical procedure. This bill would also require parental consent. Supporters of the bill say parents should have a say when a minor is terminating a pregnancy. Republican Senators Dennis Baxley and Kelly Stargell are two of the bill's supporters. Here's what they had to say.
I cannot imagine a situation where my children would have no say in what happens with their minor children. That's just a basic construct. I can't. The school cannot give them an aspirin, but someone can take them as a minor child to make a decision that is an invasive surgical procedure.
I think it's a fundamental right to have parents involved with the relationship with their child. I think that parental rights is vitally important.
Critics argue that the bill would complicate a minor's ability to access abortions. Among them is Charo Valero. She's the Florida State Policy Director for the Florida Latina Advocacy Network, which is part of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. She joins us now from Tallahassee. Welcome, Charo.
Thank you for having me.
And to note, this parental consent abortion bill is sponsored by Vero Beach Republican Erin Grawl, and WLRN has reached out to her for comment and has not heard back. First, Chato, there is a current Florida law right now that requires parents to be notified when a minor goes to have their pregnancy terminated. How does that work?
Yeah, and thank you for uplifting that, right? We know that in the state, you currently already have to notify parents, right? So parents are already involved in this process. And providers, whether they be provider centers, like a center like Planned Parenthood or doctors, they already have internal policies. Given the current political climate and given the situation in politically in Florida, people are already, or providers are already, extra cautious and taking all the necessary precautions. We hear from folks in Tallahassee walking us through the process, and a lot of folks in these centers are already have notaries and make sure that the parents are already there. This isn't about involving parents, right? This is about continuing to add barriers to this process
I know this bill's, as you're about to point out, it goes a step further and it requires not just parents are notified, but that there's also consent, that the parents have to agree to the teen or minor having an abortion. What happens if a teenager doesn't get parental consent?
Yeah, thank you very much for that question, because that's also one of the trends that we're seeing with the anti-repro policies, right? Then they start enhancing or adding criminal penalties to providers, right? We've seen this for years in the legislature, whether they're trying to increase liabilities or make it difficult for them to practice. So what the bill would do is, if a doctor who fails would have criminal penalties, and they'd be charged with a third degree felony, right? So these are attacks on providers, and the idea is to scare them enough so they have to leave Florida, right? And it's what they're doing when they also target clinics and force clinics to close down. And I also just want to quickly uplift the impact of what that means, right? So when we attack providers, there was ACOG research in 2014 that found that 23 out of the 67 Florida counties, that's 35% of Florida counties, do not have an OBGYN. That really is alarming when you're uplifting the impact that these policies have on access to comprehensive reproductive care.
And when we're talking about this specific bill, if a teenager doesn't have parental consent, there is a waiver process that they would have to go through. Walk us through what that waiver process would be if a parent says, hey, I don't agree, or for some reason that teen, you know, did not get parental consent for some other reason.
Right. The waiver process is called a judicial bypass process, and it would require a minor to go in front of a judge and essentially prove or show their maturity to be able to consent or have access to this procedure. And the Supreme Court found that all of these laws, there always has to be a pathway for a judicial bypass, right? So minors always have to have this way that they can prove to a judge that they can either not have an adult or guardian with them or are mature enough to make this decision. And the thing about the judicial bypass waiver is that when we're thinking there's a minor, this is a person who's under 18 years old, the clock is ticking, who knows when they found out that they were pregnant, right? We've got laws that are already limiting when they can access care. And now you are putting on a ticking clock, right? You are asking them to navigate this very complicated system where we've heard a lot of people in the legislature share their stories. And even the clerk of courts in the county sometimes don't have a direct process on how to refer people to these services. So you're asking a young person who's under a state of duress, and we already know that minors go to their guardians.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but you said you heard from the legislature, at the legislature, people talking about their experiences. Can you just talk a little bit about what those experiences are? What are some of the testimonies you're hearing while in Tallahassee?
Yeah. So one of the biggest stories that sticks out is a person who, already an adult, was sharing their story when they were seeking judicial bypass a couple years ago. And they were just talking about the burden of the process that they have to go to, calling the clerk of court, getting in front of the judge, the paperwork that they had to get together. And that's just navigating the legal process, right? Thinking about the lawyer, the funding, the time from school, writing your story, making sure that you're prepped and convincing them that this is why you need this. And then we've also had folks who didn't have that option, who weren't lucky enough and were young parents. And now as older folks with minor young folks that they're parenting are saying, we trust our young folks, we trust our minors to be able to make these decisions for themselves, and we support them, because what parents know and what research shows is that most minors will talk to parents and or their guardians, and if they can't, it's for a very unique reason. There's fear of safety. Maybe the guardian is the one who's responsible for this. Young folks are forced.
So you're talking about in an incident of rape, for example.
Yeah, for sure. Minors are forced to navigate an extremely complicated process that adults have a hard time even understanding. And on top of that, they have all these other resources that they have to deal with, transportation costs. So it just seems almost a very huge barrier and seems like the only option would be to force these minors into parenthood, which is very alarming.
And you just touched on this, but the American Academy of Pediatrics actually has said that most minors do involve their parents when considering an abortion. And they cautioned that when states require parental consent, it actually increases the risk of harm, psychological and physical, to minors. When you think of like those concerns, because you talked about time and delaying the process, how does time impact that the potential health outcome of a young person who is seeking an abortion, but you have to go through the court system and you have to meet all of these red tapes to potentially get a waiver if you don't get parental consent?
Yeah, well, essentially you'd be forcing a minor to wait later and later and later in their pregnancy. And also, just to add to that, folks at the American Medical Association, the Society for Adolescent Medicine, the American Public Health Association, there is a wide range of medical and healthcare professionals and providers that oppose this. And you did say, so 90% of 14-year-olds and 74% of 15-year-olds say that they have involved at least one parent or guardian in their abortion decision. And when we talk about safety, right, we're not just talking, so young people do talk to their parents, medical providers and associations oppose this kind of legislation. And when we're talking about the impact and the trauma, it's not just psychological, right, forcing somebody into motherhood, but it's also like when we ban.
And when you say forcing into motherhood, you mean if they're not able to get an abortion?
Not letting them get access, right.
Okay.
And when you ban safe and legal abortion care, right? People die, right? Because people find other ways of seeking this procedure. So it also makes it very physically unsafe. If you don't give a minor an avenue or support them through this process, they're going to find a way. And that's when you're also just making a safe and legal procedure unsafe and potentially lethal.
I'm speaking with Chado Valero. She is the Florida State Policy Director for the Florida Latina Advocacy Network. We're talking about a Florida bill that would require parental consent before a minor can get an abortion. Chado is in Tallahassee. The sponsor of this bill is Representative Erin Krall, and we have reached out and haven't heard back from her. But she has said in news reports and in Tallahassee during the session that parents should be involved in helping minors make decisions about abortions, that this is their right. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, so the messaging around this legislation has been that it's about improving family communication, that it's about safety for minors, and that it's about parental rights. So with family communication, right, we've already addressed that in that most young people will tell their parents. So we can't mandate family communication by law, right? When it comes to the safety of minors, because of the emotional, psychological, and physical potential trauma, we've expressed why this is not safe. When we get to the parental rights bit, it also creates a false narrative where we pin parents against young people or their children, right? Or their minors, right? It's not right. And that's why we also have parents testify who are there and support the minors that they parent, because they trust them in their decision. So we saw this in the House when they were doing their four-hour vote, where in the end, at her closing, the representative got to the true intention of the bill, right, which is just to put more barriers in front of abortion care.
Now, what
happens? And to then get this, go ahead.
What happens, you talk about barriers, and you know, again, I will say that, you know, the supporters of this are saying that this isn't about barriers, that this is, in fact, about making sure that parents are active in these decisions. But what happens when a teen is in foster care or is in the care of a loved one who may not be a legal guardian, which happens quite a bit in our community, where someone didn't go through the legal paperwork to becoming a legal guardian because a parent is incarcerated or a parent isn't available for their child in that way? How would those young people navigate something like this if this bill passes?
Yeah, and these are all great questions. And again, right, we don't have the answers to this unconstitutional bill, right? That's the ambiguity that we're living in, right?
And when we say unconstitutional, it has not been deemed unconstitutional, but you think it's unconstitutional.
Right, right. It may be deemed unconstitutional, right? And we believe that that's one of the strategies of this bill, right, is to be able then to take it to the Florida Supreme Court to then challenge our right to privacy on the state level, right? And the questions that you're asking about, what if the minor is homeless? What if the minor is in foster care? What if the minor is of a mixed status family and their parents are undocumented, right? There's a lot of things. What if a minor's parents aren't as available, right? What does that look like? They would have to then go through a judicial bypass process, or it just complicates the situation for them.
And what is the biggest concern that you have, or what are some of the biggest concerns you have that you've either heard from some of the women, parents even, that you've talked to about what this bill will mean?
So the first part is understanding that this is like the anti-repro bill that is really moving through the legislature. And we've seen for many years in our Florida legislature just attack after attack after attack on comprehensive reproductive care, whether they're attack on providers or it's just a part of it, attacks reproductive health care in a way, it chipping away at care. That is just part of a national narrative and a state narrative to just continue, right, attack providers, attack clinics, shame women, right? That is just the one side, right? The other side is that this bill being the gateway for folks to challenge this in the courts, bring it up to the Florida Supreme Court, challenge our right to privacy, and that's really the tactic of this legislation, right? To make sure that to start attacking Florida rights so that if anything were to happen to Roe, that we weaken our state constitution.
And when you say Roe versus Wade.
Yes, thank you. So that we weaken our state constitution so that it's easier to pass anti-abortion legislation. And, you know, we know that Florida is one of the strongest states in the South, right? It's our right to privacy that would be directly challenged if this bill were taken to our Florida Supreme Court, that we stand to lose, right? And it's very strategic. And this bill has been unconstitutional, has been deemed unconstitutional. It was a case like this that has made it.
Well, this bill has not been deemed unconstitutional, but a similar bill that passed a few decades ago was similarly deemed unconstitutional because of privacy issues.
Well, exactly.
Thank you so much. I've been speaking with Chato Valero. She's with the Florida State Policy Director for the Florida Latina Advocacy Network, which is part of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. You can find more coverage of the Parental Bill of Rights requiring minors to receive permission before receiving an abortion at WLRN.org. Still to come, we look at the new census numbers for South Florida and how population growth here could soon be changing.
Be a fan. Be a friend. Be a nerd. If you love WLRN, then own it. Show your support publicly with one of our cool WLRN items and be a part of the family. Go to shop.wlrn.org and get your goods.
I'm Luis Hernandez, host of our daily program, Sundial. You know all the best things come in twos, your favorite pair of shoes, a newlywed couple, a new set of earrings. And now you can get a double dose of the only daily radio program telling the stories of South Florida. Sundial is on Monday through Thursday live at 1 p.m. and rebroadcast at 8 p.m.
Welcome to Sundial. I'm Nadege Green, filling in for Luis Hernandez today. South Florida's population continues to grow, according to new census data that was released last week. Miami-Dade is ranked among the top 10 counties with the most residents across the country. But some economists say income inequality and the high cost of housing could reverse that trend in the coming years. Also, as the Census Bureau prepares for the 2020 census count, there's a plan to add a question about a person's citizenship status, and that issue is currently being debated in the U.S. Supreme Court, or it actually has been heard in the U.S. Supreme Court. Joining us now to discuss the new demographic data for all of South Florida and preparations for the 2020 census is Luke Rogers. He's the chief of the Population Estimates Branch of the U.S. Census Bureau. Luke, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Let's start with Miami-Dade County. It's the seventh largest county in the U.S. and saw about a 10% growth. What do we know about where new residents are coming from, or what's driving growth?
So with our estimates, we don't really measure the ins and outflows. We talk about net flows. And for Miami-Dade County specifically, it was growing pretty fast. I'm pulling up the numbers for you. The international migration component of our estimates, and I should probably get into what these mean in a second, was one of the primary drivers of the growth of the county. Also, the county increased from natural increase. So natural increase is the difference between births and deaths in the county for that year. Net domestic migration, so this is the difference between people moving in and out of the county from other parts of the United States, was a net loss. All in all, when you combine these three components, you get a net gain of people in the last year for Miami-Dade County. Now, Miami-Dade County is part of a larger metropolitan area of three counties, which we can talk about in a second.
Absolutely. We will definitely talk about Broward and Palm Beach counties as well. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like what you're saying is the growth in Miami-Dade is really from international migration and people being born, kids being born. But we're also seeing a lot of people moving out, that is also increasing in numbers. What does that tell us when you have a flow going out, and what are the implications of that if those numbers become upside down?
So yeah, the net domestic migration numbers for Miami-Dade County, they have been on the negative side for a number of years. And because of natural increase in the births, and then also the net international migration, Miami-Dade County has been gaining every year for, you know, as far as I have data in front of me. And it's been a pretty big grower. But the net international migration, And the difference between the net international migration and the net domestic migration, it fluctuates year to year. In the last year, they were pretty close to one another. The net domestic migration was a negative 52,000, while the net international migration was a positive 59,000.
And when we say domestic migration, that is people moving into the county from other places, whether it's other parts of the state of Florida or other parts of the country.
Correct. So because it's a net, we can't really say where they're coming from or where they're going to, but it's to and from other counties in the United States. And the same is true for the net international migration. We can't really say where the people are coming from or moving to, but we can say this is the difference.
Can you talk a bit about why these numbers matter and how they're used?
Sure. So these numbers, we make these every year, and they end up being the official estimates of the population for the United States between decennial censuses. The way we make these numbers is, I think, very interesting. We start with the 2010 census, and we work our way forward every year using administrative records on births, deaths, and migration, and then also some survey data. And every year, you know, we work our way forward calculating the change in the population since the 2010 census. And these become really important as controls for big surveys such as the American Community Survey that's here at the Census Bureau. But they also become denominators for rates from other agencies. And they're used for federal funding allocation purposes. And then also states can utilize them for planning or their own purposes.
And when we talk about like how different groups, services, agencies use these numbers, there is concern that in the coming years, the number of people leaving Miami-Dade will or may outpace those coming in. What will that mean in terms of how federal dollars are allocated or how, you know, monies are dispersed in a county that has a declining population or could potentially have a declining population?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say. I'm an expert on trying to make these numbers as accurate as we can, but how they're used and how the different planners and states choose to use them, I'm not sure. I couldn't answer.
And how does what's happening in Miami-Dade compare to Broward County? What are you seeing in Broward?
So Broward County actually had the largest numeric increase in the last year of the three counties that make up the Miami-Dade metropolitan area. And Broward County typically in the past has gained from natural increase, net domestic migration, and net international migration. However, in the last couple of years, that's changed a little bit. It's still gaining from natural increase, but it's starting to lose from net domestic migration. In the last 2 years, it's lost approximately 15,000 to 16,000 people. However,
and these are people moving out of Broward County into other places, but we don't know where they go.
It's a difference of people moving in and out. So yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, they're net domestic migrants, so it's not a flow. It's a difficult answer. But the other aspect of this change, and one of the reasons why it's the largest numeric change of the three counties in the metropolitan area, is because net international migration is offsetting the net domestic migration losses.
And what about in our other neighboring counties to the north? We have Palm Beach and to the south, Monroe counties. What are some of the changes or trends that you're seeing?
I think it's really interesting. So Palm Beach County, which is, you know this, to the northeast, has natural decrease. So this is an instance where there's more deaths than births in the county, and it had natural decrease the last 2 years. But it does gain, unlike the other two counties we were talking about, it has been gaining from net domestic migration and it gains from net international migration. So it ends up making Palm Beach County, when you add these all together, it's the fastest growing county. And when we talk about largest and fastest, we typically reserve largest for numeric change and fastest for percent change. And in Palm Beach County's case, it grew by 1.1% in the last year.
And Monroe County?
Monroe County is also pretty interesting. It's also experiencing natural decrease. So it's had more deaths than births. And it's experienced natural decrease since 2016. Now, Monroe County has a total net migration loss, and that is the losses it's getting from net domestic migration are more than the gains it's getting from net international migration. And the result is that Monroe County is actually losing population overall. In the last year, it's lost about 1,600 people, or it's declined by 2.1%.
I'm speaking with Luke Rogers. He's the chief of the Populations Estimate Branch for the U.S. Census. The U.S. Census recently released 2018 numbers about how populations are growing or shrinking in counties across the nation. And they're also prepping right now for the 2020 census count. We'll pivot to that. Every 10 years, we're supposed to take account a census of the U.S. population. But this is more than just counting heads. The census information is used to determine everything from how federal dollars are dispersed to determine how many congressional representatives each state gets. Talk about why there's such a strong push to get those numbers right.
Well, as you said, the census is really important for a lot of reasons. It's in the Constitution. But we also, for the estimates, we use it as our starting point. And so in the case of the estimates, which I know the most about, it's important that if the census is accurate, because it will affect our estimates for the next decade.
And can you explain the process, the tallying process that you're about to embark on?
So for the estimates, we start, we start with the 2010 or the in the next decade, we'll start with the 2020 census. And we have birth records, death records, and we have other administrative records on domestic migration. And then we use survey data and some other methods to estimate international migration. And we collect these records throughout the year, and then we start putting them together. You know, there's a process of cleaning and preparing the records to make sure they fit in with our method. And then we start generating our estimates according to the methodology that has been developed over several decades, really, by demographers at the Census Bureau.
And around this current census that's coming up, a controversial topic has been what question will be included on it. And there is a question on citizenship. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments about including that question, and it's expected to make a decision on whether it'll be included by June. Critics and census experts say adding that question could suppress responses and result in a loss of funding for many communities. We don't know what the court will decide, but how could this potentially impact the work you're doing?
Well, the questions that are going to be on the 2020 census are really handled outside of my area of expertise. What I can say is that, you know, I personally have been really excited about the releases that we've had going on for the last week. And then I'm excited about other data releases that are coming up in the near future. In May, we're going to be releasing housing unit estimates for the nation's states and counties, but we'll also be releasing the nation's city and town population estimates. And then in June, we'll be releasing the whole nation, state and county population estimates by demographic characteristics. So we'll be able to see the age, sex, race, and Hispanic origin composition of counties and states.
And what are your next steps in your preparations for the 2020 census count?
So my area, we use the 2020 census to evaluate how our estimates have done in terms of accuracy. So we're preparing on how we're going to actually do those evaluations. So that's our big focus.
I've been speaking with Luke Rogers, the chief of the Populations Estimate Branch for the U.S. Census. The U.S. Census recently released 2018 numbers about how populations are growing and shrinking in counties across the nation. You can find stories about the U.S. Census and the ongoing debate over the citizenship question that may or may not be included in the 2020 census by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Still to come, a new exhibit at the Mocha Museum in North Miami dives into the world of Haitian art. It tells stories from the capital of Port-au-Prince. Welcome back to Sundial. I'm Nadege Green, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Haiti's historical and cultural traditions are being represented in a new exhibit called Port-au-Prince, The Urban Artists of Port-au-Prince, at the Museum of Contemporary Art in North Miami. From the music, Raga, hey, to food and artwork. It will showcase work from 20 Haitian and Haiti-based artists with a focus on the island nation's capital, Port-au-Prince. The exhibit shows a slice of life in the bustling city through a variety of sculptures, photographs, and film. Joining me now is one of the co-curators, Leah Gordon. Also with us is Jean-Daniel Lafontaine, a renowned Ougan or Vodou priest from the Temple of Narive, based in the Bel Air, Port-au-Prince neighborhood. Lafontaine also served as a special advisor for the exhibit. Welcome, Leah. Welcome, Jean-Daniel.
Hi. Thank you, Nadege. Thank you for having us.
We also have photos of some of the artwork on our social media at WLRN, at WLRN Sundial. First, Leah, tell me about how this exhibit came together. Why Haitian art with the focus on Port-au-Prince?
I think a lot of it is to do with my own sort of history as a curator. I've done a sort of survey show in a contemporary art gallery, well, museum in England, which was a survey show of sort of Haitian art since the 40s. And I've also worked on the curatorial team of a kind of more ethnographic exhibition at the Fowler Museum at UCLA. And we kind of were really thinking that we really want to do something that was just totally contemporary to show that sort of Haitian art is not kind of this kind of art that's stuck in its kind of history and its art history and its past, that there is a really, really vibrant contemporary scene, especially amongst like the majority class artists in Port-au-Prince. So we based the show around certain areas, zones of production in Port-au-Prince where work is being made to this day.
And Leah, what are some of the themes explored in this exhibit?
In a way, I mean, I think one way all the work is linked is that they are from majority class neighborhoods, and very often they are sort of interconnected sort of groups of artists that work together.
And when you say majority class neighborhoods, what do you mean?
I mean, oh, that's a difficult one to answer, I suppose. I mean, not the elite classes.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's just from, okay, got it.
Yeah. It's the majority class in Haiti.
And Jean-Daniel, as one of the consultants on this exhibit, when you think of Port-au-Prince, what do you think of?
I think of chaos. But chaos.
If you've ever been to Port-au-Prince, indeed.
Yes, but chaos in the sense of creativity, chaos in the sense of chaos that nurture life, that nurture who we are, and that nurture the explosive creativity and art skill of the Haitian people.
And when you said chaos, I immediately said yes in my head. But for maybe if you've never been to Port-au-Prince, when you walk out of the airport and you head down, what are you seeing when you say, like, what are some of the visuals? Like, if you could paint a picture of Port-au-Prince.
Sound and colors. That would be the first thing that would come to mind. And added to that, it would be smell of different sort. So it's a chaos for the senses in many ways. And I think that in a certain way, the Port-au-Prince, the exhibit, is a representation of all of that in a very contemporary setting.
Say more on that. How is that reflected in the show? Are there any pieces for you that stick out, or how is it reflected in the entire body of the work that you have at the show?
Every single piece for me is a typical representation of Haiti as we can feel it. The Haiti and the Port-au-Prince of the senses. I would speak about one particular one made by an artist called Soleil from the Grand Rue, made of pépé shoes. For those who don't know what it is, pépé are secondhand clothing sent to Haiti that are resold. And he find a lot of these old shoes, and he said that now he's going to send them back to the U.S. so they can be sold at very high prices. So this is also part of the chaos of Haiti.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's so tied to Miami, because so much of the Pepe vendors are based here in South Florida. And so looking at those connections across the diaspora. Leah, for some of these artists, it will be the first time their work is being displayed outside of Haiti. Talk about the importance of building an audience and building your body of work, not just in your home country.
Well, the one thing that's always really surprised me, I first met the main group of artists that I work with are the sculptors of Grand Rue, and I first met them in 2006 when I was sent here to commission a permanent exhibit at the Museum of Slavery in Liverpool. And the one thing that really struck me is where they live, you know, like a space is really limited. Their houses are very small. The tiny corridors that connect them are really minute. But this didn't stop them from having this kind of real kind of extravagance of scale, making pieces of art that were like twice the size of the houses they lived in. So there was this sense, you know, in a way, it's all crowded into this neighborhood. It's just like a kind of a feast of kind of sensory kind of power. And, you know, in fact, when I first ever saw it, I think even since 2006, it's always been an ambition to take some of that out and place it in the white cube and to allow the pieces to breathe on their own and people to really see this incredible kind of output.
And Jean-Daniel, this exhibit looks at the intersections of Haitian history, music, politics, and religion. And you cannot talk about religion in Haiti and not acknowledge, pay homage to, or just know about Vodou. How is Vodou represented in the artwork, and what is it saying?
First, we have to take Vodou outside of the religious context. Vodou is at the basis of Haiti's revolution.
And absolutely.
It's at the basis of Haiti's birth. So it is omnipresent in our culture. And I would really recommend that people separate the Vodou practice, the Vodou adept.
And for people who don't know the context of how Vodou played a role in just the very beginning of Haiti and what it is, can you just give us a little bit about that?
Sure. Vodou is a mix of different religions coming from Africa, mixed with the religions of the natives of Haiti, and with a hint of cultures coming from different parts of Europe and different countries of Europe at the time, whether it's England, because Haiti was actually occupied by the French, the English, the Spanish. So there is an influence of all these cultures, and it's a melting pot that create, if you want, that culture, which has within it a religion called Vodou. So it's at the genesis of Haiti. So everything is impregnated by Vodou, whether the person is an adept practice or not. The lullaby, for instance, as a kid, a lullaby about Vodou spirits quite often. So you cannot take Vodou away from the inspiration of the artist. And some of these artists may not even be Vodou adepts, but they are certainly influenced by the music of Vodou, the colors of Vodou. There is an entire narrative of Vodou in their work, and there is an aesthetic of Vodou as well.
And what is that aesthetic? Can you place
yes.
it?
Yes, it's the mixing of multiple culture in the context of post-colonialism. So it's the creativity of slaves that became free, fighting and beating the greatest army that was the army of Napoleon Bonaparte.
And we're talking about the Haitian Revolution.
We're talking about the Haitian Revolution, and we're talking about the pride of these people transpiring through Vodou in their artwork.
I'm speaking with Jean-Daniel Lafontaine from the Temple Narive, based in Bel Air, Port-au-Prince. He is a special advisor for the exhibit Port-au-Prince, the Urban Artist of Port-au-Prince. Also joining us is the co-curator of the exhibit and British artist Leah Gordon. Leah, one of the 20 artists being represented in this exhibit is Tipelin. He is from Haiti and does massive stone and metal sculptures. Explain to us some of that work. What does it look like? And just finding inspiration from environment.
Well, the reason why Tipelin, I think, is so important is the fact that the very materiality of the work he makes is so linked to the sort of geography of his neighborhood. He comes from a neighborhood called Rivière Foix, and it's above Carrefour, and it's where the river called Rivière Foix runs through this neighborhood as it goes down to the sea. And in the past, this river was actually bringing these huge lumps of limestone down. So on one level, the materiality of the work comes from the river. And also, the most important spirit for him is a family of spirits called Simbi, who are the spirits of sweet water. And also, Simbi is like a sort of magician. He's one of the trinity of magicians in the Vodou cosmology. And what's really important, there's one piece of work that he told me about, which is this giant head that he made for Simbi on des Eaux, which means Simbi of two waters. And he placed it in the center of the river. And he placed it as a kind of mystical marker that when there's a drought and the river goes down, the face of Simbi on des Eaux arrives and shows you and kind of warns you about the environment. And when times are good and the river is very full, then he's disappeared again. So it's, I really like the way that for Tipalén, he makes these works, and these works are kind of markers about the perils of the environment themselves.
And Jean Daniel, if you can speak more on Tipalén's work.
What I would mention about Simbi, because Leah is extremely knowledgeable about his work, but the spirit of Simbi has a duality in it. It's not only the spirit of water, but it's also the spirit of fire. And that duality is interesting because the rock itself is an element of fire, of water, of earth, and of air. So it represents actually the four elements, which are the pillars of the not only the Vodou cosmogony, but of Vodou itself as a religion. So this is quite interesting.
And talk about presenting this work here. South Florida is a huge hub for the Haitian community, and specifically in North Miami, it's a very Haitian community. The entire city nearly the entire city council at one point was all Haitian. But presenting the work within the diasporic framework, bringing in artists that are Haiti-based Haitian to a community in the U.S. that is also very much Haitian-based or has a point of reference that is very close.
Yes, it's quite interesting that the exhibit is in Miami, which has one of the largest diaspora of Haitian in the world, if not the largest. But I'm going to let Leah speak more about one important aspect of the exhibit, because I don't want us to focus so much on the Vodou part, because even though it's all the work is Vodou inspired, and I suppose that everything that's Haitian tends to be Vodou inspired, whether you are a pastor preaching, you preach in a way that's very Haitian. And in fact, that makes it somehow the Vodou way of doing things. But focusing on Vodou, I think will take away the contemporary aspect of that exhibit. And it will maybe lead people to focus on something that's not essential in that exhibit. So bringing it to Miami, and because of the diversity of the community, of the Haitian community, many of them being Protestant, Catholic, and some of them being Vodouisant, I don't want to stigmatize, if you want, the exhibit by calling it a Vodou exhibit or focusing on the subject.
Absolutely not. We don't think it, but, nor did we say it was a Vodou mm-hmm. exhibit, but there is no denying the context of what inspires work.
Absolutely. Many of the pieces are certainly inspired by Vodou, and some of the artists are actually Vodouisant, people that do practice Vodou, are adepts of Vodou, and create some of their work for the purpose of Vodou, or for the spirits, or for the loi.
And Leah, say more about contemporary art within the Haitian context, because there sometimes is a perception of what Haitian art is, and it's much broader than right. perhaps the stereotypical perceptions of what is Haitian art. Talk about what is being produced, and what does that contemporary art look like, and some of what we're going to see.
Well, one thing I would think is worth looking a little bit back into the history is that a lot of Haitian artists, especially the majority classes, have suffered under the kind of stereotypes.
And when we
of,
say majority class, we mean everyday people.
Yeah, naive, outsider artists, because they're self-taught, they haven't been to art school. And in one way, you know, the show and also a lot of the artists are a challenge to this. They see themselves as contemporary artists, but just because they're self-taught, they still want to be taken seriously as contemporary art producers. And so one of the sort of ideas behind this show is to kind of present this work as all contemporary artists practicing now. And I feel personally there is kind of, to a certain extent, there's a lot of slippage in the kind of this kind of symbolic coding that is used, visual coding in Haitian art. And this, for me, has real kind of relationship to postmodern art, where the slippage between codes and visual languages also is used a lot. So I think there's an awful lot for contemporary Western artists, American artists, Haitian diasporic artists to gain from having a look at this work.
And yeah. I was going to say to Jean Daniel, I think one of the things that especially struck art lovers is after the Haiti earthquake in 2010, one of the major things among everything that happened is there was so much art loss. There was a lot that was just destroyed that you just can't bring back. Can you talk about the narrative of what it means to create in Haiti in the past few years?
You know, I like to refer to Veve on that particular instance. Veve are very intricate designs drawn generally on the floor to call upon spirits. They are very much like Kabbalistic signs. And some Veve would be traced for hours. And in a matter of seconds, the spirit would come and destroy the Veve. For me, the destruction of art also creates more art. And many of the art that we have currently at that exhibit are art that were inspired, not only by the quake, but that were made possible because people could find skulls, for instance, in the rubbles that they could use to make artwork. So the lost art, and there was not so many art lost in reality. There was monument that were lost and we did some art, but most of it has been not only recuperated, many of it has been restored. And so in terms of loss, it wasn't a terrific loss, I would say, but I think that the creativity after the quake increased because of the access to new material and a new way of thinking life.
The exhibit will have an opening reception on Saturday with a special performance by Gaga Lakai, which is the Little Haiti-based Gaga band. This group originated in Little Haiti and plays weekly. Leah, much of this exhibit is about creating a sense of place, things that will make you feel that you are present within the Haiti-Haitian context and also celebration. Who is this exhibit for?
I could say the exhibit is for everyone in Miami to go along to. I mean, certainly one thing we didn't want to do is just have a set of objects. So we do have a whole program of screening that goes on for about 9 hours worth of films, many films made by Haitian filmmaker Raoul Peck, amongst many other filmmakers, which will show lots of different aspects of life in Port-au-Prince. So even though the main objects show one reality of Port-au-Prince, we're hoping that the photography and the films will help show different layers of context in which this art is made.
And Jean Daniel, if you can jump in on the layers part, because the art is not just, as Leah just said, the visual objects, but even the importance and the sounds of Gaga and what that means in this space within a museum context.
You know, it's interesting because The one of the most important instruments in Gaga are actually the drums and what they call the bamboo.
Which is a handmade horn.
It's a handmade horn, yes. And quite often, and in the past, it used to be made out of bamboo, actually. And it's interesting because the sound is an imitation of the heartbeat and of our respiration. And we believe that these instruments were also used in the fight for independence as an element that would help those fighters, l'armée indigène, transcend and become new people, valiant people. And we think that the Gaga band gives you that same emotion. As the Gaga band is playing, it takes you to a different dimension. And this is why I think it's something that's extremely enjoyable. So it's great to talk about the Gaga, but in the context of the exhibit, I think that the food, the smell of the food, the cinematography, the film being there, the photograph, and the artwork themselves, that melting pot is a recreation of the Port-au-Prince.
I've been speaking with Jean-Daniel Lafontaine, special advisor for the exhibit Port-au-Prince, the urban artist of Port-au-Prince, and co-curator of the exhibit Leah Gordon. The exhibit will have an opening reception this weekend at the Museum of Contemporary Art in North Miami. And that's Sundial for Thursday, April 25th. I'm Nadege Green. Lewis is back next week. Thank you so much for listening.